Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to Ad Exchanger Talks. My guest in the studio today is Evan Edelman. Evan is Vice President of Programmatic at Condé Nast. And as you certainly know, Condé Nast publishes GQ, Vanity Fair, Wired, Epicurious, Vogue, Teen Vogue.
Teen Vogue.
Welcome to the studio, Evan. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Zach.
Oh, and I didn't say I'm Zach Rogers. I'm the executive editor of Ad Exchanger. Good to be with you again. I should also say Evan will be speaking at AdExchanger's Programmatic I.O. Conference in New York City this October 25th and 26th, joining a panel titled Data Accuracy in the DMP. Full conference agenda is now live on the website. Take a look. Come ask Evan questions. And a little more background before we get started here. Once upon a time, Evan was an executive with PubMatic, so maybe we'll talk a little bit about that.
Yeah,
we'll see.
Sure.
So, Evan, give us big picture, you know, a little background on Condé Nast and its journey as a seller of ads and ending with programmatic. Where was it? Where is it today?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Condé's been doing programmatic for a while, many, many years. I don't know if you remember, or maybe you actually published it. They were the first publisher to open up a private marketplace, I think in like 2010 or 2011 with back in the day when AdMeld was—
If I wrote that story, I don't remember.
Was still AdMeld.
But that's fascinating.
But they've been in the business of programmatic for a long time. And I think over the last 2 years with the growth of programmatic being both a transaction type and a vehicle for marketers to leverage, we've really taken a look at how do we go to the next level and what are the new capabilities that we'd want to launch across the portfolio and for our products for the salespeople to be able to push and market.
Okay, great. Now, and going back even further, quite a bit further,
yeah,
maybe 15 years further back.
Oh, boy.
I mean, I think Condé Nast, at least Wired, was the first digital ad,
correct.
The first digital ad that ever appeared.
Yes.
Is that correct?
I believe so.
Banner ad.
I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe around 1995, right?
Yeah. Probably was not that easy to traffic.
So I bet it was not. So a lot of firsts from this company. You know, obviously Condé Nast is associated with premium and high quality media environments. Maybe not with tons of digital scale historically, and they may be, you know, that may be changing. Certainly with programmatic, if you're a seller, you want to be providing scale to mm-hmm. capture the interest of the biggest buyers. Can you talk about that? When you came in a year and change ago, what kind of scale was available to agency buyers from Condé Nast versus today?
Yeah, I think, you know, the scale was there. The setup to give access to the scale wasn't as mature as I think it could have been about a year and a half ago, right? Condé Nast, I mean, huge portfolio. We're 23 brands now, over 120 million uniques across the properties every single month.
Mm-hmm.
Huge footprint on social media as well. But one thing that was a big opportunity was access to that scale and giving a programmatic buyer a look at our inventory at a higher placement within the ad stack than we were treating it historically, right? I think a lot of, and I don't think Condé was alone at the time, I think people were still treating programmatic advertising as remnant,
mm-hmm.
right? And a means to monetize unsold inventory,
right,
rather than a vehicle for marketers to be able to gain access to audiences at scale and then be able to transact electronically.
What percentage of your digital supply is available programmatically as a first look or at least equal footing with a direct sale?
Yeah, we make all of our inventory that is products that are able to be transacted programmatically open to a buyer at that level.
Okay, you do. Okay,
yeah.
Great. And, you know, you mentioned PMPs. Private marketplaces, how do you structure them? How do you run them?
Yeah, we put when we looked at the new capabilities that we were rolling out last year, private marketplaces weren't getting a whole lot of scale. And I think that was because of the way we were setting them up and not leveraging some of the technologies out there that would allow us to reserve inventory on behalf of an advertiser and let them to the decision against it, or target a PMP at a higher priority inside of our ad server. We package up PMPs leveraging header bidding that allows a buyer to really get access to the inventory through reservation. And what I mean by that is we'll literally talk to an advertiser and try to work on as many one-to-one deal IDs as opposed to one-to-many, because then we can understand the objectives of the campaign, the audiences they're looking to reach, and really package up or reserve inventory for them to be able to access that fits that objective.
Okay, got it. And then can you say, maybe you can't say, but roughly what percentage of your programmatic revenue is going through these PMPs?
I would say more than 50% of our programmatic revenue is PMPs and PG.
Okay, terrific.
Yeah.
And here's another maybe you can't say question, but what percentage of revenue is programmatic on the digital side?
That I wouldn't be able to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. Fair enough. It's my job to ask. talk about your ad stack. Who are your partners, if I may, and what are the components? Ad server, header bidding, SSP, et cetera.
Yeah, we work with Google is our Google DFP is our ad server. We're invested in their stack of programmatic guaranteed products that they offer. We run inventory inside of AdX. We leverage server-to-server integrations as of late, both inside of Google, so EBDA, as well as Amazon. And then we run, on the client side, we work with Index Exchange, which powers our premium programmatic product.
Okay, great. And what's been, to your eye, the impact of header bidding on your business and the publisher ecosystem as a whole? Been around for a few years now?
Yeah, it has. You know, it allows us to do a lot. So one, the scaling of PMPs, because it gives the buyer the right access at the right priority. That access and setup also allows us to take advantage of unforecasted traffic spikes that we see across the portfolio from, you know, the enormous amount of content that we produce every single day. And a lot of times there's content that we produce that goes super viral, and having the ability to leverage header bidding and PMPs targeted through those channels can take advantage of that increased volume.
Right, because that used to be just, you know, a wasted opportunity for so many publishers.
A major hit on a
website like Teen Vogue. I mean, good example of a publisher, a brand that didn't have, you know, a lot of visibility with an audience outside of its core demographic.
Right.
But during the presidential election cycle, started breaking major stories.
Major stories.
And got, you know, global attention. I can't imagine what the traffic was like. With header bidding, you could seize on that a little more easily.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, great. What about the so-called ad tech tax and, you know, the yield that you're able to get in a header bidding world? I'm sure you can't give me a number, but could you, you know, qualify that at all? Like, what's been the impact on your business of header bidding and lower margins and obscure fees paid to the middle layer?
I could shed some light on that.
You keep a little more of every dollar that the advertiser spends.
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal, right? I think through header bidding, you know, everybody on both sides of the equation has become more transparent.
Yeah.
And has given us a view into, you know, what that tax is. And most importantly, though, it's just given us the ability to dial up bid density across all of the inventory that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, really creating a auction that has an enormous amount of volume that comes through with multiple different platforms going after it.
Impressions are just clearing at higher prices.
Yeah.
Across the board?
For the most part, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you able to easily forecast where an impression is going to clear, or are you still in the phase of header bidding where it's scaling up and you don't know where the ceiling is?
No, I think we're getting to a point now after being at it for about, you know, 14, 16 months now where we can start forecasting where things are going to come in outside of those unforeseen traffic spikes.
Okay. All right, cool. So it's not so much about taking margins out of the ad tech layer, keeping more of that for yourself. It's more about the bid density in terms of the value header bidding creates.
Yeah,
okay,
definitely.
Got it. We'll talk more about maybe those margins in a few minutes when we get to the SSPs. Your data strategy, though, would be interesting to hear about. How does Condé Nast think about its data asset, and how does it activate that?
Yeah, we are investing significantly in our data platform. We've built an in-house DMP. We leverage Adobe as an out-of-house DMP. We sit on millions and millions of subscriber records, email addresses, you know, tens of millions of records inside of there. We operate a survey that we send out to our consumers on a daily basis. Lets us understand who they are, what they like, the brands, the categories that they're most interested in. And we try to allow advertisers to leverage the platform as much as possible to create either audience segments that are granular to what they're looking to target, or come up with situations where we can start connecting our database with our clients' database and doing overlays and matches to create audience pools for them to target.
What about the home address asset for a large subscription-based media company?
Yeah, it's big.
It's big?
It's big, yeah.
How are you able to leverage that?
Well, you know, there's knowing who the person is, where they live, what magazines they subscribe to. We then get their email address, right? And that sort of acts as a unique sort of identifier that allows us to start matching the offline database to our online pools of audiences.
Right. I would imagine that the home address helps with when you're matching to an advertiser or a marketer's own data.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, if they're looking to do a first party or a CRM type campaign.
Absolutely.
Okay. Sweet deal. And last question on Condé Nast strategy would just be distribution partnerships. You know, you guys, as you made reference to, you know, social media distribution, video on YouTube. You know, I realize this may not be entirely your wheelhouse, but how do you think about monetizing on those channels, relying on partners like Google, Facebook, and Snapchat to sell a share of advertising and give you that cut, whether it's 70% or 100%, versus hoping that they will give you the right to sell into those environments?
We, whenever possible, cut those deals where we have first right of sale. So that's how we definitely look at our distribution partnerships. Definitely not in my wheelhouse of putting those deals together, but when they are put together, it affords myself and my team and a lot of, you know, everything that, for our advertisers, the ability to get access to greater scale. And I think there's distribution partners out there today that are looking for premium content to be able to provide brand safe environments to their consumers. And there's no doubt that that's the heritage of Condé Nast. So it puts us in a good place to develop strong partnerships in that area.
What about matching audiences on those platforms? Do you think, do you see that on the horizon?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Short answer. Compelling. I like it. Okay. So let's talk just a little bit about some marketplace issues, ad tech trends. Your background in PubMatic makes me want to ask you, what do you see as the role of the SSP, the future of the SSP, now that you are their target customer? Are you interested in buying what they're selling?
We do. We do. I mean, the SSP today still plays a role. There's no doubt about it. The ability for them to bring in demand, for them to create connections, DSPs, as well as providing us with, us as a publisher, technology to create a competitive landscape for buyers to come in through the programmatic channel.
Okay, great. But do you think, what do you think the companies like Rubicon and PubMatic look like 2 years from now?
I don't know. I think that's an interesting question.
Index Exchange, AppNexus.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interest in what they do look like. I think they continue to enhance their business models to support the way that buyers want to purchase. And I think that really just continues to focus on decisioning on an impression and giving a publisher controls on how they price and push the inventory into those environments.
Okay. I'm just struck, I mean, by how that your description of their future involves creating value for the buy side. I'm curious about the sell side. Like, what can they do for you? I mean, I think maybe a different way to come at it would be to sort of ask the question, how do they make money? And I think a lot of them have charged, you know, margins around 20 to 30% historically. Correct me if I'm wrong. I may be a little off on that. And that those margins are coming down. And, you know, I think Michael Barrett, the new CEO of Rubicon, has said very clearly, you know, margins are falling. I've spoken with other senior executives at other companies in that competitive set saying, yeah, they'll come down maybe sub 10, maybe sub 5%. And that's not, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's how technology markets mature.
Mm-hmm.
Margins shrink and the whole infrastructure becomes more efficient and consolidated. So that's not necessarily bad for these companies. But, you know, maybe we're looking at a future where there's only two or three rather than, you know, the seven or so we have today. Maybe there's only AppNexus and Google. What do you say to that?
I think that it probably isn't too far off,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, the margins will be shrinking. It becomes much more competitive with many more platforms out there. Figuring out how to develop themselves, not to go back to the demand part, but more products for publishers to be able to push through their platforms,
mm-hmm.
I think will allow them to sort of mature and continue to stay alive.
Okay. So there does remain a need, from your point of view, on the publisher, part of the publisher, for
yeah.
technology tools.
Absolutely.
Outside of just a server-to-server integration.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you for fielding those high-pressure questions. The quality push of 2016 and 2017, led by people like Mark Pritchard, the chief brand officer at Procter & Gamble. To what extent has this drive for, you know, highly viewable, highly human, and high-quality inventory translated into increased revenue for you
mm-hmm.
and other sort of high-end premium publishers like yourselves?
I think the pendulum swung very much towards audience, right? Doesn't matter where the person is or what they're doing. As long as I know that I'm reaching that person. And I think we're coming back, and we've already come back to a point where context and placement is extremely important, right? I want to make sure that I'm reaching the right audience, but I also need to make sure that it's in a brand safe environment with premium content that the user is consuming. I think it's going to continue to shift that way. And that shift has definitely helped companies like Condé and I think other premium publishers capture the right advertising dollars.
Okay.
You know, I mean, some of the pressure that they put on with the viewability and things like that, you know, it's here or there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. With Amazon, do you see a strong partner to Condé Nast? You know, obviously they're pushing hard into publisher side
mm-hmm.
tech.
Yeah, they've been a strong partner of ours. I think, you know, they themselves, I mean, sit on an enormous amount of data.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think about what advertisers are looking to do and the pools of data that they can choose from, that's a pretty rich set
mm-hmm.
for them to use for sort of targeting purchase behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's going to be a lot more coming out of them.
Are they reaching out to you, briefing you, asking for meetings, sending people to your offices?
Oh, yeah.
They are.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, we see them often.
You do. Okay, yeah. Great.
They're
great.
Definitely out there in the market.
Serving the publisher.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that they will end up with a an ad stack competitive with DFP or Google?
I think they will end up with products that compete with Google, definitely. I don't know about maybe a pure ad server, but I can foresee them building out, heavying up on their buy-side tools.
Okay, great. Talk about talent for a minute. You know, programmatic is now 8 or 9 years old, and publishers are used to selling this way. What for a while early on to see a programmatic in someone's title, such as you have in your title, was surprising to see a programmatic executive on the publisher side. These days feels maybe a little more standardized. Do you think there remains a talent drought around this practice area of programmatic inside of the publisher? How is the profile of your team changing? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still needed in regards to having the technical expertise on data sales and talking to buyers about audiences, right? And I think the tech landscape is still so big and confusing for a lot of people, whether you're a digital first publisher or not. I think there's a lot of knowledge that's still needed to support those types of conversations.
Okay. And who are you still hiring for? Like right now, how many openings do you have?
Right now, we're focusing on support for the business. So we're definitely going to heavy up on that. We have a pretty large sales team now.
Okay.
About 6 people that focus on programmatic. And
is that the right size, or are you still growing it?
We're growing it, absolutely. We're heavily investing in that channel. And, you know, it's a transaction type that spans across the company as well. So everybody out there is talking to their clients and agencies and partners about programmatic transactions.
Okay, got it. Yeah, so how do you handle that training for the non-programmatic sales?
It's a lot of
person.
Training.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've rolled out a training program across the organization that spans past just programmatic. I mean, it relates to video and content and everything else that we produce and sell. Training is ongoing for everybody, including myself. And every day you wake up, there's another article, there's another technology or product that's coming into the market that we have to know about.
Yeah.
So we leverage a lot of our partners. We put series together internally. We have classroom training across the organization.
Yeah, the half-life of expertise in this industry is only about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I just took a vacation and I came back and I felt almost irrelevant. cool. And
or people that used to sing in this room probably never thought that someone would be in here talking about programmatic.
No, and it's best they never know.
Yeah, exactly.
So what is the ideal profile for a programmatic seller? You know, what's the background you're looking for? Do you want somebody like yourself who worked at an ad tech company selling ad tech? Or would you rather have somebody who's good at selling media, selling brands, who can learn the tech? Or is it some hybrid?
It's a hybrid. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a hybrid. I think you have talent that's growing up in the tech world, that grows up in a world where they learn about media and brands and content. And I think you have people that have grown up in that part of the world that are learning about technology. And I think it's those that can really perfect that sort of that merging of those two sides that really is successful in the world today.
Okay, great. So companies like Condé Nast and Time Inc., Hearst, old school print sort of companies with print roots. I think the whole world is watching these companies, rooting for them largely. I know I am. But there's a real question about change management and how well they can adapt to new publishing environments, new selling environments. There's all of these digital upstarts like Vox and BuzzFeed. You know, I guess Vice to some extent, or Refinery29, that they were the hotness 2-3 years ago. Some of them are hitting road bumps today. I'm curious, how do you you know, I'm asking you, who are very biased on this question, but how do you rate the progress of Condé Nast and its brethren in the old media ranks at self-reinvention, specifically around monetization? How is this going?
What do you mean?
Like, how's it going? Is the monetization of old school media brands gaining speed fast enough to save their businesses?
I mean, you know, I can't speak for the others. For us, I'm super impressed by what's going on at Condé. Mm-hmm. I mean, the brands that we own and operate are iconic, and they're mm-hmm. brands that people have been following and attached to and part of for 100 years. I mean, you know, Vogue is celebrating their anniversary this September. That's going to be big. I'm impressed by the way that the company is pivoting both in regards to the investment in parts of our business like Condé Nast Entertainment. I think also in the partnerships that we're creating with platforms out there and our ability to keep driving and growing our audiences across the properties. I mean, you know, there's a huge part of the company that's focused on getting everybody on the same platform and increasing our products and focusing on digital-first opportunities. I think it's impressive. I mean, our audiences have grown multiple year over year.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would agree.
I mean, I've been there too.
I would very much agree that I'm struck by the extent to which the old guard has embraced technology in some ways more fully and wholeheartedly than the new school. You know, in talking with BuzzFeed and Vox, that class of company, they've been very slow on programmatic. Many of mm-hmm. them disavowed it and are only now starting to come around and embrace it in a meaningful way. Whereas Condé Nast, Time, Hearst, throw Meredith in there too, really early and active experimenters. So I think there is a mindset of, hey, let's, you know, a sandbox, I guess, mm-hmm. where the companies have allocated money for hires, tech people, and sellers who get it. And I think that's probably paid off.
I would agree with that.
So thank you so much for coming in. Great conversation.
Thanks for having me, Evan Edelman.
And to the listener, thanks for tuning in to yet another episode of AdExchanger Talks. We'll see you next week.
Produced by Bigfoot Music and Sound in New York City.